Good morning. Spirit thought for Adam Maguire on to talk about the business of Formula One.
Dotted around the place, the lower down you go. One of the biggest deals in F1 is Shell.
Sorry, Adam, I'm just going to interrupt you there with some breaking news. Leo Varadkar is to step down as Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader. The cabinet has been meeting in government buildings in advance of this announcement.
And just like that, on Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, Leo Varadkar held a press conference in the courtyard of government buildings and stood down as Taoiseach.
There's never a right time to resign high office. However, this is as good a time as any. My reasons for stepping down are both personal and political. There are loyal colleagues and good friends contesting local European elections, and I want to give them the best chance possible. And I think they've a better chance under a new leader. On a personal level, I've enjoyed being Taoiseach, leader and a cabinet member since March 2011. I've learned so much about so many things, met so many people who I'd never got to meet, been to places I would never have seen, both home and abroad. And I am deeply grateful for it. And despite the challenges, would wholeheartedly recommend a career in politics to anyone who's considering it. However, politicians are human beings and we have our limitations. We give it everything until we can't anymore. And then we have to move on.
Well, did anyone see this coming? It would seem not. Word for the day, shock.
We've Regina Doherty with us, Fine Gael Senator. Did you know about this?
Absolutely not. No, I think we're all a bit shocked this morning, all a lot shocked this morning.
Hi, Fine Gael TD Fergus O'Dowd with us. Are you as surprised as everybody else?
I'm absolutely shocked, Claire. Believe it or not, I came up to Leinster House to go to the gym this morning to be early. And I'm not going now, obviously, but
right.
That's why that's the truth. And I'm absolutely shocked.
Alan Farrell is with us, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Fingal.
Absolutely shocked, Claire. It is a bombshell. It is a shock, a surprise, insert adjective here.
And I want to go to Colin Brophy, Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West.
Today's news is shocking, yeah, to everybody because it came so unexpectedly.
Yeah, but
and on the News at One, Diane O'Connor brought us the views from Leo Varadkar's constituency of Dublin West. And yes, you've guessed it, more shock.
I'm very surprised. Very surprised. I don't think there was any sign of it coming. So, yeah, but can't blame him either. The amount of criticism and, I suppose, abuse that politicians get nowadays, I can't blame him.
Very surprised. He's been a very good constituency politician for Dublin West. He was actually in my primary school, and I wish him well for the future. It seems to have been a closely guarded secret.
It's the first I've heard. I'm just shocked.
Paul Gore's and political pundits also reeling, especially with the June local and European elections hurtling down the track. With Claire, Professor Gary Murphy from the School of Politics at DCU.
It may be the case, and we don't know this, that Simon Coveney, perhaps Pascal Donoghue, they might have known about this in advance. But it seems from what we're hearing that many other cabinet ministers, and certainly those in Fianna Fáil, did not know about this decision. How do you think they're going to respond to it, given that they're likely caught off guard?
I think they'll be quite shocked, Claire. I'm not sure what the relationship at the moment is between the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste. I think it would be just gobsmacking if Micheál Martin hadn't been given some notice that the Taoiseach was about to step down. I mean, it's an extraordinary time, really, in Irish politics that a Taoiseach would step down so close to an election. And remember, Leo Varadkar was desperate to get the top job in 2017 when there was various machinations which ultimately led to Enda Kenny resigning in the summer of that year. And then Leo had the contest all wrapped up in the election with Simon Coveney and was in the Taoiseach's office in jig time. And now to basically call it quits within 9 to 12 months of a general election after he's only has fought one is, I think, extraordinary. And politically, it's simply not a good look for a Taoiseach to call it quits in this in the regard that the current Taoiseach seems to be going to do, Claire.
Okay.
But who knew what and when? On the News at One, this clip from a press conference with Fianna Fáil leader and Tánaiste Micheál Martin.
Last evening, after the normal leaders' meeting, the Taoiseach asked myself and Eamon Ryan to stay behind. And so he briefed us in terms of his plans and he told us what he was intending to do today. I was surprised, very surprised, didn't expect it at all. On a personal level, I, as I said, a very good relationship with Leo Varadkar. I think the three party leaders have always been in a position to resolve any policy differences. We had a good process in terms of flagging issues, updating each other on particular issues. And on a personal level, we got on well. I think that was important in terms of the smooth running of the government. And from that perspective, you know, it's not something I had anticipated. But I do wish Leo the very best. And not an easy decision for him to take. A lot of courage in that decision as well.
And with Brian, this from Green Party leader Eamon Ryan.
The leader of the government is leaving the government. He's walking away less than a year out from a general election. Now, that can't but have a destabilising effect on the coalition.
I don't think it will. And I think, I suppose, again, from the personal level, I think he's been in ministerial office for about 14 years as leader of Fine Gael for some 37 or so. Mm. That does take a toll. It is demanding. But that's a personal decision. And I think what you can only do is respect that and respect the honesty of the
It's a personal decision, Imran, with political consequences. There'll be a new Taoiseach. They'll have to settle into the job. There'll quite possibly, quite likely be a reshuffle, if only on the Fine Gael side of the government. And all of that is going to take its toll on a government really within sight of an election.
But I think we're quite experienced, and this government has shown actually the ability to manage a rotation in the Taoiseach's office. And in the past, I've been in similar circumstances when there was a change of Taoiseach within government. So I don't think that's impossible.
And as the dust settled, and it didn't take long, a cruel business. A sense that this, although unexpected in its timing, well, it was not necessarily entirely unforeseen. On Drive Time, this view from Barry Lenehan.
One minister who will be loyal to him telling me that the timing perhaps is right to do it now. The local elections, if Fine Gael have what they hold, they got around 24% of the first preference vote last time, that would be a good day. And perhaps now was the time to look at it. Others, the press corps who were in Washington with him, saying that the writing was on the wall, that there was a dinner at Blair House in Washington with 30 of his most trusted advisors and confidants last Friday. But another saying, speaking to the Taoiseach, looking at his speech earlier on, that perhaps Mr. Varadkar had become simply worn down from the job or had fallen out of love with the job over recent times, and that they were surprised perhaps at how self-deprecating he was in his speech, saying people will decide and may have their own critiques of his time in office, and perhaps simply that the criticism from others had become too much, which is of course a point which has dominated political discourse this week, following of course the decision from Kieran and Cannon as well to not stand in the next election.
Okay.
However, leave it to Joe to keep a little perspective on things.
Why are you sad to see the Taoiseach resign?
It's just a bit sad. Like, you know, I liked him kind of as a person. He seemed to be, you know.
But he's only, like, he's not dead.
No, I know he's not.
He's only 45.
I know.
He was the youngest ever Taoiseach. He's the youngest ever Taoiseach resigning. But he is very young. He looks extraordinarily healthy and fit.
Yeah.
So,
well, he could go on to
wish him well. Wish him well.
Oh, I'm wishing him absolutely, Joe.
And he
And callers into Liveline had praise for the outgoing Taoiseach, with most citing his handling of COVID as a high point. Winning award for the most effusive, Leonora.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Are you a member of Fine Gael?
I am a member of Fine Gael. Yeah.
Are you a rep? Are you a public rep?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Very good. Okay, Leonora, how are you? Are you over the shock?
Well, just about. I got a terrible shock because I think Leo's amazing.
And where were you when you heard the news?
Holding a cup of coffee in my hand, which I nearly dropped with the fright.
And what do you think the high point of his term as Taoiseach was?
The high point, I think, for me was COVID.
Okay.
I just think he wrapped his arms around us. I remember I was looking after my sister at the time, and the two of us, I remember watching the speeches on television and just thinking, wow. I mean, he really did. And if you look back at his popularity ratings at that time, they were enormous. Yeah. He made us all feel secure. Himself and Simon Harris, they made us feel secure. And I think that's the best thing you can do for anybody.
From Liveline, But while thoughts of succession were almost immediately on everyone's mind, Wednesday was the day that no one wanted to declare their hand unseemly. No, this was Leo's moment. A view exemplified by this clip from Minister of State Jennifer Carroll McNeill on Drive Time.
Is Simon Harris and Pascal Dunhu the front runners?
I think it's time now that we don't speculate on that today, to be honest with you. I appreciate it's interesting and it's, you know, it's certainly the chat around Leinster House about who's going where and all of that jazz.
You'll
but
be
to
putting
be honest
your name
with
forward,
you,
will you?
But to be honest with you, today is a day for respecting and reflecting on what Leo has brought to public life over the last 20 years. We have a parliamentary party meeting this evening.
Well, it's a short time frame. People have a right to know, surely, who's running. Are you running?
I'm not. I really think it's too early to speculate.
You're not
on
counting
that.
Tomorrow,
I am going to West Cork with Tim Lombard.
And on Late Debate with Colm Mungon, even former Fine Gael TD Kate O'Connell was being grilled.
Who combines the room working attributes that Enda Kenny had and the public communications attributes that Leo Varadkar has that could be the sweet spot for Fine Gael members to vote for as maybe a better electoral bet?
Do you think I'm going to kick off another 7 years of choir boy talk or some sort of situation like that? Well,
we did have hope when we invited you.
I don't think it will be helpful, and I'm not within the parliamentary party at the minute. So things change.
Would you be tempted to seek to seek election again?
What I have publicly said is that I would not run for Fine Gael as long as Leo was leader. And obviously that changed at lunchtime today. Just that point changed. I have a job, a life, and I'm very happy.
But it did obviously change one of the
barriers or issues that would be outstanding. But as to my future, today's not for that.
Okay.
And I don't know is the answer either
for
that
midnight.
Matter.
It's nearly tomorrow.
Well, at that, I actually don't know.
Okay.
Meanwhile, opposition parties, well, looing for a general election. Here's Sinn Féin's Ona Brin with Sarah.
Okay.
How long
is
are the
Sinn
people
Féin
in emergency
ready to
accommodation?
Go, if there was a general election called within the next couple of weeks, are you ready to go?
I will be ready to put up posters tonight and fight the general
election
tomorrow.
Not just you, though. Is the party ready
Absolutely.
To go? Do you have your candidates ready?
And not only are we ready, but the electorate is ready. I'm out canvassing regularly for our local and European election candidates at the minute. People want change. They're fed up of a tired, out-of-time, out-of-date Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael government. Let's put it to the people, not to a parliamentary party, a third of whom aren't even going to contest the next general election.
From Wednesday's Drive Time, and then Minister for Enterprise Simon Coveney ruled himself out of the race. But by Thursday, the game was well afoot. On Morning Ireland, Fine Gael's Neil Richmond had this urging for one particular colleague.
Do you think there will be a contest? I mean, you're out this morning here on Morning Ireland telling us that you're supporting Simon Harris. We've already had senators, councillors and so on. There's a feel of an orchestrated campaign about this morning, that Simon Harris is getting his people out early, a show of strength to perhaps frighten off other candidates. Is that what's happening?
No, I think I had the opportunity to come on to speak about Leo's legacy and where I think our party should go next time. I took that opportunity. It's always a good opportunity. If there is to be a contest, I think that will be a good thing. You had Alan Dillon on earlier. We've laid out very clearly what our timetable is. I've been through leadership election before in the party. We are looking towards Ardèche on the 6th of April to have a new leader in place to set ourselves forward for the local and European elections and in due course into a general election.
And are you expecting then that Minister Simon Harris will announce that he's contesting this leadership election later today? Is that your expectation?
I certainly hope so.
Well, you must have had conversations with him. You know what he's going to do.
I don't specifically know what he's going to do. I have had conversations with him, but I hope he's actually listening to this show, Justin, because this is an appeal from me as an ordinary member of Fine Gael and as a voting member in Dublin Rathdown to ask him to run for the leadership of our party, to take up that mantle and let us build a much better party and a much better country going forward.
And we do like to think Simon Harris was tuning into Morning Ireland, because as the morning progressed, Ministers Helen McEntee, Pascal Donoghue and Heather Humphreys all ruled themselves out. It seemed like it was time for Taoiseach Simon Harris. On the news at 1, this from Paul Cunningham.
It's looking very much like the Simon Harris bandwagon is unstoppable at this stage, Paul.
I think it's over. I think Simon Harris is going to be the next leader of Fine Gael and the next Taoiseach of Ireland. We do have the capacity of a candidate to stand up till lunchtime on Monday, but with both Heather Humphreys and Pascal Donoghue announcing this lunchtime that they're off the pitch, it's hard to see how anyone is going to stand against him. It's possible, but it seems highly unlikely.
That was Thursday afternoon, and of course, it's not over until it's over. But with the Fine Gael executive deciding yesterday to bring the closing date forward to Sunday at 1, it's looking pretty likely that the Wicklow TD will become Taoiseach, a position he had set his sights on from an early age.
His ascent to top office is no surprise for many.
Harris's assault on the leadership of Fine Gael, a well-rehearsed plan, we're told, hatched long ago. Now, Simon Harris set to become the youngest ever Taoiseach at 37 years of age. But one leader in his hometown of Greystones told me earlier how the story goes locally that in third class in St Lawrence's National School, when all the children were asked what they want to be when they grow up, a young Simon Harris replied, Taoiseach. Mm. His involvement...
And so it goes. What a week. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Moonagas Wild, the giant redwood tree, the sequoia. Such a beautiful word. Roll it around your mouth. And the naming of these majestic trees has a very interesting history.
Sequoia is an intriguing character. He was a Cherokee, member of the Cherokee Nation in North America. His father was a Scotsman and his mother was a Cherokee Nation member. And he was responsible for writing down the Cherokee language. So he developed an extraordinary alphabet that he used. It had about 60 letters in it, 60 or 70 letters, and he purloined alphabets from all around the world to essentially make a written language for the Cherokee people, who had never had a written language up till that point. And so he introduced the whole idea of literature, mm-hmm. and what the Cherokees referred to as talking letters. So they were able to send a piece of paper to somebody else who could then hear them talking, if you like. So this was a phenomenal breakthrough at the beginning of the 19th century. And the Cherokee Nation became the most literate nation on the planet. The literacy rate was something like 90 to 95% wow. of the Cherokee Nation could read and write down their Cherokee language. And here in Europe, you know, at that point, early 19th century,
it was a lot 40 lower.
To 50% of adults were literate in that same way.
That's extraordinary stuff. It's amazing what you learn on the Mooney Show, Matthew. There's no doubt about it.
Derek. But he's not wrong either. And that was Dr. Matthew Jebb of the National Botanic Gardens. And he was on to talk about the sad death of one of their sequoias. In fact, their tallest tree. Here's Dr. Richard Collins.
If it was some kind of a fungal infection, how did it get in? I mean, the trees are there for a century or more. How did they pick up a fungus now? Why now?
I think the simple problem is the climate's not what it used to be. And, you know, whilst, you know, people perhaps turn their eyes up a bit when they hear climate change being mentioned yet again, this is a very critical and serious problem. So a tree might have been happy for 150 years, but in the last 50 years, the climate of Dublin has changed drastically. We have, you know, a very different warm winter now. We have much earlier bud break, but there's a lot of early warmth in spring. And we're also now getting big winds. So all of these are threats to plants of all shapes and sizes. And the wretched redwood probably is finding it a struggle. And therefore, it can become susceptible to disease, just like a stressed animal is likely to develop an infection, simply because it's living under a lot of stress. And the hormone balance in its body actually predisposes it to become more affected by a disease that might otherwise have been fairly harmless to it.
From Mooney Goes Wild. Last night on Witness with Siobhan Garrigan, this question.
Do you think that the ocean works as a metaphor for the divine, given that it's life-giving and intimately connected with our own ongoing recreation as beings? but also mostly mysterious.
Nothing but the profound this week. And the answer came from surfer and scientist Eski Britton, a woman for whom being in the sea is a reminder of just how much we are at the mercy of the elements.
My experiences in the ocean as a surfer is all about surrendering control, that letting go. Again, that kind of feminine energy you need more than anything else when you're in the water. Because if you're meeting the water or a wave with any kind of resistance or tension, you know, it'll just exhaust you. And that won't end well. I mean, the shadow side of it is that thinking that the ocean was just so vast and unknowable, it could contain everything, including all of our waste, and we'd never notice. And we're realizing actually it's not limitless in that way. And also then the mystery that it holds is important for that, I suppose, our own imagination and creativity, that spiritual connection. And yet, what impact does it have then on our collective consciousness to discover that there's no part of the ocean where we haven't left our mark or our imprint? Even in the deepest parts of the ocean where we've never been, there we are.
Surfer Eski Britton on Witness last night. Now, though, for a change of gear. With Oliver on Thursday, Maeve McLachlan Doyle. Her husband, former Gartha Mark Doyle, was recently sentenced to 6 years in prison after pleading guilty to 6 charges of assault causing harm to his wife and his 2 stepsons. She spoke to Oliver about living with abuse and coercive control. And her story is a distressing one. And for some, it may be particularly upsetting. So please bear it in mind. When Maeve met Mark, she was 25. She was working full-time for Glanbia, owned her own home and had 2 sons. And she described herself as outgoing, confident, ambitious. However, over a 12-year period, her entire sense of self was undermined. Yes, there was physical violence, but also abusive and threatening behaviour.
Look, it's a horror story. The list is endless. Yeah. But I think what the worst part was really was the intimidation every single day. So if you think of living in your house, in your home, safe space, but you're intimidated every day, like by somebody. So there's always this menacing kind of behaviour. For instance, sometimes when I'd be cooking, he'd always be standing too close. And so I ended up getting burns on my hands and stuff like that. Or you'd be, I remember one time my sister said to me, why are you walking up the stairs? I'd always walk upstairs on the wall side. Because you do things like grab you through the banisters, you know, pull your legs, make you slip, or when you'd be showering, coming into the room. So nowhere was safe, not even the shower was safe. And like, you'd be making out, oh, sure, I'm only messing, or you can't take a joke and stuff like that. But if somebody's constantly harassing you like that, it becomes so, you just, I can't say, I'm losing what I want to say. It becomes...
It was an all-encompassing terror, tiny torments.
So there's no escape.
She would have 2 children with Mark Doyle, and while it may have looked idyllic from the outside, theirs was very far from a happy home. She recalled one incident. They had gone to get their Christmas tree, and they were travelling in 2 cars. She was driving in front. Mark phoned them.
He says, you're driving up the guys in front of you, the arse of the car kind of thing. And I was like, you know, when you actually start guessing yourself, I was like, am I? And then I was like, No, I'm not. Like in my head, I was thinking, no, I'm not. But then I was like, maybe I did. And anyway, so then we get, so that confusion's already set in motion. So then we get to the car park in Maynooth where the trees were sold and we're picking the tree. And he starts going about getting the takeaway, which takeaway we get. And the kids were deciding Chinese. So that was grand. So the arrangement was he'd take the tree and I'd go and collect the Chinese on the way home. So then we got into the house and the kids were sitting there. The two kids that he had with him were sitting there with McDonald's. And I'm going, did we not say we were getting Chinese? So then I said, did we not say we're getting Chinese? I got Chinese and is that not a waste of money? Like just a normal conversation. Like, am I going mad here? And that escalated into a massive row then where there was plates of food hammered off the wall. My older sons tried to intervene. So he got me by the hair and to show them like I'm the boss, like, you know, and he literally walked me up and down the hall like a dog. Like that's the way I describe it, with my older son screaming. My daughter was only 1 year old at the time in the high chair roaring, everybody crying, you know, the kitchen smashed up. Still to this day, I don't understand the rhyme or reason of having to put that sort of fear, terror, you know, all about control. But like all set up from the very start, from that phone call at the beginning of the journey, that I was tailgating somebody, you know, to put this constant unstable thing in my head where you're going, was I tailgating somebody because he's driving behind me? Maybe I was coming around the lights and I didn't.
Logic just couldn't break through for you. Yeah. But what was, should be a joyous moment in a family bringing home the Christmas tree.
Yeah. So with the results now, every single year with the Christmas tree, you know, it's remembered, you know, it's always remembered because it's a thing. Like the same with the communion, with my eardrum getting burst, that's a memory. It just seemed to be every single occasion. We couldn't let an occasion pass. You'd be dreading it, actually. You'd be dreading occasions coming up because you'd be like, what's going to happen now? And that kind of thing that I'd explained there now, that kind of setting up little unsureties in your head like that.
Yeah.
You know, this happened or that happened or he did that, to put a blame somewhere, either with myself or the boys, and then it would escalate and escalate.
And although the physical abuse was there, as she told Oliver, it was the constant undermining of her self-esteem that will stay with her.
I've often said, and even said to the guards that dealt with me with the case, like, you know, it sounds bizarre, but like the physical stuff kind of heals up, and not that you get over it, that's not the right words, but there's
the body repairs itself to an extent, but
yeah, there's
the mind
an end point to that. But the emotional abuse is what would probably be the trauma, the lifetime trauma, because it was never ending. Like, it was just all the time making you unsure yourself, making you on edge, repeatedly calling you names. I've always struggled with up and down weight. I mean, that's just who I am. It's always who I am. I've been a size 10 to a size 18. And he'd constantly pick us up on that. And when you're a person that struggles with something like that, you know, it does get in on you. Like when somebody's constantly calling you fat or look at the state of you or, God, did you see those pictures of yourself? You know, it does start to really grind in
on
you.
Yeah.
And I remember even with myself, I think after I had my daughter, I lost a good bit of weight. I did like all the women, I did Slimmer World or whatever. And then when that was an issue, he just changed to something else.
Right.
Then it was always money, that I was terrible with money.
He'd everything covered, every possible.
So it was always like it would switch. If something, he realised something wasn't getting to you anymore, it would switch to something else.
And of course, her husband was a serving guard and his public persona was the very measure of respectability.
He'd said up to the public that he's a pillar of the community. He's a guard. He was a local scout leader. He was a plaster in the army. He'd be doing voluntary jobs for that and all this kind of stuff. But he'd also be also sending out the message to people all the time that, you know, Maeve's a little bit naive or she's a bit ditzy. She can be all over the place. Like, look what I have to live with. Like, you know, like if it wasn't for me kind of keeping her in tow, God only knows what she'd be, or, you know, this kind of thing. So
that's classic controlling behaviour to make sure that. It's so clever in a way, isn't
it's
it?
Very
that if
clever.
You say something to someone, that they'll probably dismiss it.
Yeah, because they have a whole perception of you that is given out by the abuser. So because of that, then it's very hard. And you know that as well yourself. You know that's the perception of you that's gone out there. So you're thinking, and you start thinking it yourself. I started to believe it myself. God, I am a bit forgetful and I am a bit chaotic sometimes. But then when I look back now, there was a reason, because he was orchestrating so much craziness in the house all the time. That is why I was forgetting things and shook and a little bit all over the place, because I had somebody undermining me at every corner that I turned, like, you know.
However, after yet another visit to her GP, she contacted women's aid groups who gave her the support and advice she needed to get her and her children out of the situation safely. In September 2019, she applied for a barring order, and then, in early 2020, she made a complaint to the Gardaí about her husband. He's now in prison. She and her children are rebuilding their lives.
Mark Doyle, he took everything that you were for those years, but not everything you were going to amount to be. You're still a young woman now. You've got you've got control back.
It's funny, people saying I'm a young woman. I feel like I'm 90. I always say that. I feel like I'm 90 years old. I have got control back, and I'm literally just going to, as the next few months for me now is going to be trying to sort a new place to live. Mm-hmm. I'm back in college. I'm trying to a new career, and
it's looking ahead.
Looking ahead and realising, and that like relief of, as I said to you, I think earlier on, of not being in arguments about, you know, wash baskets or something not being where it is. Or
tell me about the recent Mother's Day.
I remember just that day I had forgot to do the clothes washing on the Saturday, which would have been a massive issue. And just looking and going, at the Wash Basque going, there's no issue about the Wash, and thinking, why was there an issue about washing? Like, who cares if washing doesn't get done for two more days than when it was done? You know, so even now, yeah, there's still times in my head I'd look at things and go, oh, thank God. Like, you know.
Those tiny moments of I'm free.
Tiny moments of
You'll
I'm free.
You'll decide when the bloody washing is done.
Every week. Like, I still have those moments every week of realising that, you know, little things are not big things anymore. And, yeah, do you know what? Things today, tomorrow, everything can be left till tomorrow. It's okay. Like, it's okay. There's no worry.
And I can hear, I think you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
I think we all hear that you're going to be okay now. So I think you have won something. You've won your control and your freedom back.
Yeah, no.
And listen, thank you so much for retelling this awful story and a terrible crime.
The very remarkable Maeve McLaughlin Doyle with Oliver on Thursday. And should you need them, rte.ie/helplines. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Described as an audio adventure, St. Patrick's Day Forever had author Pat McCabe taking you by the hand for a little trip around the dance floor, or maybe by the scruff of the neck for a traipse through the backfield.
Patrick Cavanagh was coming from Carrickmacross, making his way back to the townland of Mucker, when he heard John Lennon calling out to him across the valley. What was he calling the beetle on that day? On that smoky end of summer day now so long ago. I am he, as you are me, and we are all together. Crab a lock of fishwife, stupid bloody Tuesday, man, you've been a naughty boy, you let your face grow long. Maybe. And what was Patrick Cavanagh thinking as he sat there watching the sun as it came through the eye of a bridge? Perhaps of his death the following year. With his ruminations, perhaps, punctuated by a sympathetic shower, perhaps, of sparrow notes. As profuse, one likes to hope, as the shoal of currency that he had reportedly called into being one dead afternoon in the crepuscular light of McDade's public house, when he'd remarked, "Do you know what, gentlemen? There's damn all wrong with any of us here that a good shower of favours wouldn't cure." As Paddy Cavanagh sat on a tumble-down wooden stile, watching as his neighbour Paddy Nugent went about his business thrashing corn in a townland that, border or no border, hadn't changed in 1,000 years. What might he have said to him? It has often somewhat giddily and mischievously occurred to me. Yes. What might he have said to Yoko Ono's husband on that day when he'd heard him call the world to revolution behind Nugent's Haggard? What might he have said in that valley long ago, I've often asked myself.
Love, love, love. Ooh, St. Patrick's Day Forever from Bank Holiday Monday. Now, there are few things more gleefully entertaining than a review of something really quite bad. Step Up horror film Immaculate.
If you couldn't remember anything of having seen the movie 2 hours later, you'd be a happier person.
I believe it's several types of movie.
Well, it's primarily a really bad horror movie, but it did have this sort of secondary effect. We both went to see it in a crowded cinema. There's a point where a horror movie is so bad that everybody's laughing at it. Everybody was cracking up because by the end of the film, she goes from being this sanctimonious nun, novitiate, to being an absolutely kick-ass final girl while giving birth. So she's in the full pangs of labour while burning the house down. By this stage, yeah, the cinema wasn't exactly what the narrative put it that way.
And it sounds to me like real gritty realism here, Justin.
It started well, that's all I'll say. It did start like a horror film and it did come to this fork in the road where it could have gone Rosemary's Baby, it could have been like Supernatural or even Psycho, where the natural is even spookier than the supernatural. And instead, it goes to like A View to a Kill, a not very good Bond movie. And it turns out the priest is a Bond villain with this insane plan to bring back Jesus with some blood that he found that's on this nail in their basement. And it's just like, what?
Ooh, wincing in anticipation of the star count from Arena reviewers Justin McGregor and Ruth Barton.
I'm giving it one star for Sydney Sweeney and one star for the fact that it is quite short. So two.
All right.
Mine's 1.5. You know, I know why she wanted to make it. There are these Gialli films, these Italian horrors, and it would have been great if it had been one of those. And they had great titles like Death Laid an Egg. And all right. I think maybe Immaculate Laid an Egg.
Maybe So Bad It's Good. On Drive Time for the 7th year on the trot, Finland, the world's happiest country, all according to the UN-sponsored World Happiness Report. Philip O'Connor is an Irish journalist based in Stockholm, yes we know, Sweden, but the Nordic countries all featured at the top of the table. And it turned out he was something of a charmer.
How happy are you?
My happiness levels are always off the charts when you call me to talk about these things, Sarah. So indeed you as well, Cormac.
Liar.
Not at all. It doesn't really surprise me at all. And it was fascinating to see the results. I think you'll see that many of the countries in the top 10 there, and certainly in the top 5, they come from small countries with not huge populations, with very good social services, very good safety nets and that kind of thing. Also high taxes, but people live in very, very secure environments and have a good standard of living. And I'd imagine that has played a very, very large role in the fact that they've done so well in this index for so long.
Always about the healthcare and the education.
Do you think people in Scandinavia know how happy they are?
I think there's a certain smugness about it, all right. I do really think that people know that they have a very good existence here, but they're very, very modest people as well. You have this thing here, the law of Jante. You should never think, and you should absolutely never say that you're better than anybody else. But they might just do it this week with the Finns 7 years in a row now. That's a pretty good record.
It absolutely is.
By the way, Ireland, 17th, down from 14th last year. So we're a little bit sadder, it seems. Aww. Also looking at the same report, psychotherapist Dr. Coleman Nochter, he was on with Ray, because it was young adults who were the most unhappy, those fit young things, the prime of your life. That, it seems, has flipped.
Traditionally, those 18 to 30s were the happiest bunch, and the 60 pluses. And it's kind of flipped on its head really over the last years that they're now scoring the lowest, which, as you say, I think that point about a midlife crisis is interesting, because I think maybe there's a perspective in your 20s that, you know, a midlife crisis is when you reflect on your life and kind of feel that you've not achieved what you'd hoped, or there's a kind of a sense of a bit of resignation. Whereas I would see that in young people, young adults as well, where they're kind of writing themselves off as having opportunities when they're in their early 20s. And there's that kind of sense that, sure, what's the point? I'm 25 now. And you're kind of thinking, you know, you're only starting out in your careers, and it is about managing expectation. But I think it is hard, and I think the social media piece, while it is a convenient villain, it is playing a role in it. That bombardment of the highlight reel of everyone's life that we've talked about, Ray, for a long, long time,
yes,
it does have an impact on young people feeling any sort of traction in their lives or that they're succeeding, because you can never succeed enough, because there'll always be 10 people who seem to be doing better.
And going round telling young people that these are the best years ever. Relax, enjoy them. Well, that is rarely useful.
I'm treating a lot of that age group. Whether I think this is millennial nonsense and roll my head at it, it doesn't make any difference. I still have to meet them where they're at.
It's their reality.
Yeah. And again, if someone's mood is really low as a result of feeling that they've kind of wasted their lives, you know, I kind of have to work with them to see. And
you
almost
can't
have, provide
you can't
a counter narrative.
Cop on, you're only 22.
You can't, because that's everyone's saying that to them, and that's not necessarily having any impact on how they feel at that moment. And I would have, I suppose, a few years ago, been cynical to that kind of millennial entitlement view, but now it's almost like, well, it doesn't matter what I think. I just have to help them to move from where they are into somewhere that is a little bit more balanced, a little bit more realistic, and has a better perspective of their own capacity.
And maybe we need to readjust expectations as well, because that striving for happiness, you're just going to be disappointed, aren't you?
Yeah, I always remember I used to go and talk to transition years, and you used to ask them, you know, what percentage of your life do you think you feel happy or should feel happy? And then invariably say between 85-90%. And then I'd ask them what happiness is and show them a picture of these two minions laughing, and they'd say, yeah, that's happiness. And then I'd say, would you be shocked if I suggest that you spend about 1-2% of your life like that? Which is real. You know, the idea that happiness is that hysterical bent over laughing is a very momentary experience. Mm-hmm. None of us spend our lives like that. Freud would say, you know, the most you can hope for is the misery of everyday life. And while, you know,
cheery.
No, but while it's grim, it's a bit more realistic than you can be everything you want to be once you believe in yourself, which is, again, you know, I would say equally
Misleading. But I suppose, like, Buddhism would say that life is a struggle, it's suffering. And I suppose if you accept that, that then anything is a bonus.
Yeah, and again, I would urge us not to pathologize life.
Yes.
Not all worry is anxiety. Not all sadness is depression. These are ways in which life, it's a way of navigating life.
It's being
life.
Human.
It's part of the human experience.
Coleman Nocter, of course. It is always useful to remember, well, you'll soon be dead. Yes, and with Brendan, Mitch Albom, his best-selling book, Tuesdays with Maury, explored his relationship with his college professor who was dying. And from that, lessons on how to live a good life. But Brendan wasn't sugarcoating it.
The thing is, we're all dying at various paces, and I suppose that time is all we have. And so that maybe if we all realise, well, we're dying too, do we get that perspective then?
Well, you would hope if everybody looked at, you know, as Maury said, if you take every day as if there's a bird on your shoulder, and each day you get up, you ask the bird, is today the day I die? And of course, every day of your life, the answer will be no, except one. But are you prepared if the bird says, yes, today's the day you're going to die? Are you going to say, oh, no, I can't, I haven't done this, I haven't done that, or are you going to say, well, that's all right, I've lived my life the way that I should have, and I don't have regrets because I didn't get around to, you know, seeing my loved ones or being good to people or doing that charity work that I thought I was going to do or whatever, and you're content in how you've lived your life.
And if you think all these little nuggets of wisdom sound cliched, familiar, cloying, even trite, yeah, you could certainly see it that way. But they might also have merit.
Well, people get critical of things that are cliched or sentimental. And I always say, well, that's because they're true. You know, if you're constantly looking for something that's brand new and that nobody's ever thought of before, you know, chances are it may not necessarily be true. But the fact that a lot of people have repeated it or said it or cried over it doesn't make it bad. And the truth is, if you live every day as if you're dying, you will be more content. And when the day comes that you actually do die, you know, you're much happier and at peace with how you've spent your time and your days.
And that would be as good a place as any on which to wrap the programme. Life lessons, death, all the big issues. But this was also good.
Last night I stayed up watching how cashew nuts are grown, which will blow
your... Hold on. Cashew.
Cashew nuts. What did I say?
You said cashew.
Is it cashew?
No,
what is it, cashew?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a sneeze. It's cashew as opposed to cashew.
Cashew. No, what is it? No, cashew.
No,
Niall is saying it's cashew. Cashew.
No,
I said it like how people... I remember I was in Mayo years ago and somebody said, Lucozade. I was going, is it not Lucozade? What is it again? Say it. I'm going to write it down here. Cashew.
Cashew, yeah.
Cashew.
Say... this is phonetic for you now.
Right, okay.
This is really good radio. K-A-S-H-O-O. Cashew.
Cashew.
Yeah, cashew.
Cashew. Okay, cashew nuts then, Darcy. Sorry.
Well done.
Right, cashew nuts. But anyway, if you Google that tonight, I guarantee you, not the pronunciation of it, but I guarantee you, no one will fall asleep. It is amazing how them... But there's hours and hours and hours of stuff on YouTube that will just... That's amazing, but absolutely useless.
Can I just ask you, Bernard,
yeah,
how you ended up on a documentary about cashew nuts? Was it? Did you feel a need to find out, or did it happen on your feed or whatever they call it?
A friend of mine told me that they grow off the bum of apples. And I went, this is not true, right? He said they grow off the arse end of apples. I said, that's not cashew.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Now I can't say it.
Yeah.
But look it up tonight on YouTube and you won't go to bed.
And just before they signed off.
But I'm just going to tell you before you go, because this is important, because it could keep you awake tonight.
Yeah.
That cashew nuts grow off the cashew apple.
I said that to you. I actually said that. Niall, did I say that to
Bernard,
him?
See you, Bernard. Bye,
no,
Bernard.
No,
Shea,
I said that. I want that on record.
Just
now.
Fade him down there. Sarah and Cormac are on the way.
Oh, poor Bernard O'Shea. Well, we are almost out of finish, but not quite. And for the week that's in it, a little blast of Kylie. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.